Welcome to Scenes. I'm your host, Lenny, and I'm delighted to say that in this episode, I'm joined by someone who I both admire and I'm mad envious of due to their seemingly never-ending list of talents. It's director, filmmaker, writer, and fashion stylist, Basma Khalifa. We talked about everything from growing up as a child of the diaspora through to her brilliant debut documentary. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. How are you, Basma?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm not too bad, thank you. We had a few technical issues trying to get this set up, but we're all good now, aren't we? Good.
And also recording this in real life, IRL, and it's lovely to sort of look at someone while you're doing it.
Rather than for a screen.
I could touch you if I wanted to, it's so lovely.
Can you tell us the first thing you remember falling in love with?
First thing I remember falling in love with? The first person I fell in love with was my mum. Which makes sense, right? Because I came out of the womb and there she was.
The first person you saw.
First person, and my longest and most important love is my mum. So yeah.
And it's an everlasting love.
It's an everlasting love. It never goes away. Never goes away. She's never going to go away. it's definitely my mum. Definitely.
When I initially wrote that question, the first thing that came to my mind was Elvis Presley. Which was a first love of mine.
Okay, so you wanted to do more celebrity? I mean, if I went... Like, my other first love would be my Furby. I really loved my Furby. It's so important to me, that Furby. Like, it just come out and I was like... Me and my dad would go to the... Early Learning Centre, I don't know if you guys have that or not. Early Learning Centre, and we'd go and stand in the queue and then it would sell out, and we did that over the space of a month, and I remember holding this Furby and being like, whoa, this is incredible. It wasn't incredible at all. Did nothing but make great noises. But at the time, I was like, mind blown.
I was much more of a Tamagotchi kid.
Okay, yeah, I hear you. But like, Tamagotchi, I felt like everyone had them. Like, Furbies were quite exclusive because they would sell out.
I see,
like,
yeah.
Hey, do you have a Furby? No, but I have a Furby.
Hence the queue at the Early Learning Centre.
There we go.
Being Sudanese and growing up in Northern Ireland, what was your cultural education like? And were those two worlds something that took you time to find a balance with?
Any child of the diaspora has that two world place where you are one person outside your front door, and when you go in, you know, you become the person that your parents are raising you to be. So definitely I had a very Northern Irish upbringing in high school and primary school, and it was all very Irish. But then as soon as we walk through the door, you close that front door, you're Sudanese. You have to do certain things. You know, we only really ate Sudanese food, and, you know, we obviously were raised Muslims, so we all, you know, have to do our prayers and all those things. So yeah, it was two very different worlds. But I think when you're a child, like, a lot of people say to me, like, gosh, what was it like growing up in Northern Ireland? Because I grew up there during, like, the time of the Troubles. But you're a child, like, you just do what you're given. You don't question things. You don't have enough brain capacity to be like, what is this and why am I doing it? So at the time, it didn't feel weird at all. It only felt weird as I got older. And now when I get asked about it, because for me, obviously, my face doesn't really match my accent. So a lot of people are always like, why do you talk like that? Where are you from? What? And I grew up in Northern Ireland and in Scotland. So I think now I've had to reflect on it. Being in London has forced me to reflect on it, because people have made me reflect on it. But it's just my lived experience. I don't know any different.
Mm.
So I feel very Northern Irish, and I feel very... very much Londoner now, but I also feel very Sudanese. Like, I don't know. It's not weird.
Was there a balance to find with those two things? And were there not necessarily conflicts, but things that made you question?
Oh, for sure. I think growing up as I became like a woman, you know, as I got, you know, hit puberty and I wanted to, you know, wear short skirts or go out with my friends and meet boys and kiss boys. And you want to do all these things that your friends are doing. And you assume that, like, if your white Caucasian friends are like, this is what we're doing, you're like, well, we're all the same, because I was always raised sort of, and was never, I knew I was different because I was black. And my mum always used to say to me, or she said to three of us, I have two brothers, you know, we're the only black people in this whole town, in this whole city. So how you guys behave is the representation of black people. So you guys need to represent well. And I think that became an instinct of being like, okay, yeah, no, I am different. But it was very hard. It was very hard to sort of want to be something and then know inherently that you're not. We were, you know, I'm a child of immigrants. We came here without our British passports. We came because my dad had a job, and it was very It was a very weird, I reflect on it all the time, and I just think my life in Northern Ireland was so weird but so normal. I didn't know any different. Like, how was I to know? Like, I had never really seen any other black people that I wasn't related to. So in my head, there was like two twins that were like black and like a couple of years below, and then they disappeared. So I didn't know any black people. So for me, I was like, this is my world, just all these white people. And then I think when I moved to New York, just before I moved to London, and I remember phoning my dad, and I was like, oh my God, there's so many people. There's so many different people. And he was like, that's the world. And I was like mind blown that all these people could all live in like one place and be on like, I was just on the train on their like underground. I was just like on the train, I was like, this is crazy, look at all these different people, where are they from? And now in London I'm like, yeah, it should be like this. But I think it took a long time for me to realize what that meant, and I think I had a bit of a loss of identity because I was like, where do I weirdly felt really comfortable in the white world, even though it wasn't necessarily completely my world. And then I was trying to enter myself into the black world and was like, how do I be black? Like, what does that mean outside of being Sudanese? So yeah, definitely had a bit of an identity crisis when I was a teenager. And I don't think I completely nailed it, but I think that's what, quote unquote, makes me good at what I do, if I do say so myself, is that I haven't nailed it. So I'm still sort of figuring out where I fit and how I figure this out, and I sort of like play that out in real life, I guess.
And something you said that's really interesting was what your mum told you about. You're setting an example for everyone else who looks like you. You know, at that age, that must be quite a big burden.
But again, not, because you're a child. Like, we were like, okay, like, whatever. Like, she was just trying to say that so that we wouldn't do naughty things. Like, you know, that was all it was. It was like, you have to be good.
Yeah.
So as a child, I was like, I don't really know what you mean. Like, I feel like I fit in. I'm hanging out with my friends. They don't treat me any different. Obviously, there was a bit of racism, but there always will be. And I think especially when it was like, I was so alien. Me and my brothers were so alien to other people because it just didn't make sense. They'd never seen people like that before. So there was that kind of like, the Northern Ireland's funny because they almost were like, we don't understand, so we're just not even going to attempt to understand. You just do you, because like, we don't get it.
We're not going to interfere.
Yeah. We don't get it. You don't get it. Are you Catholic or Protestant? Which one are you? I was like, I'm neither of these things. And they were like, well, you got to be one. This is where you live. And that was as far as a child as you could go. Because they don't, you know. But in hindsight, I look at it now, I'm like, what a wild, trippy time. And now I go back to Northern Ireland and I just think, it's so visceral for me now. Like, I go back and I think, God, like, I have their accent, I have their upbringing, but I am a part of them. So, it's still something I'm trying to figure out, I guess.
Was there kind of a light bulb moment where you went from cultural student to where you are now, cultural storyteller? Mm.
One of my biggest moments is when I moved, I was in London, I'd been here like 2 or 3 years, and I was still trying to sort of figure out my feet and, you know, how I kind of worked in like London society, it's like East London. And one day, I don't even know how I came across it, but I found a spoken word event, and it was very much like a black African or Caribbean spoken word event. And I remember my friend took me the first time, and I was like, okay, this is interesting, there's something in this. The second time she couldn't go, and I was like, I really want to go. Like, something, like, I felt something when I went there. Like, I really want to go. And I remember being like, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to go on my own. This is going to be the first time I go something by myself. But it doesn't matter. It's a dark room. People are just, like, performing poetry or spoken word. So I remember I went by myself. And I went to that spoken word event, I think, 4 or 5 times. But it completely changed who I was.
Wow.
It was just my first sort of, like, oh, this is what it means to be black. What they're talking about is what I feel. What they're saying is my lived experience. But I didn't know someone else felt like that. I didn't know that this was a thing. I thought it was just me. And I think going to spoken word events, I was just like, wow, this is all falling into place. So yeah, I definitely think that was a big, big moment for me. And I think, I mean, I was in the fashion industry. I've been a fashion stylist. That's all I've been. And I knew I didn't fit in. Like, we don't even talk about it. Like, fashion is just, it's a hard log. Diversity wasn't in. It wasn't cool to be black. It wasn't cool to be curvy bodied. It wasn't cool to be short. You know, you had to be a certain person to get by. And I think it was one or two knockbacks of like, you're not going to get the job. This pretty blonde girl's going to get it. You're not going to get the job. This pretty brunette's going to get it. And I think it was one too many times where I was like, I don't think this is to do with my skill set. I think this is to do with the way I look. And I can't change that. So then I'm not doing this anymore. And that's when I left.
From an outsider's point of view, looking at the work you've done, it is something you are trying to change, but on a broader scale, not necessarily directly relating to just fashion.
Right. You know, when I think of my work and think of the things I do and the things I have coming up, like I haven't actively tried to be this person, but maybe I have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
People say things like you just said. I'm like, well, I just do what I think is right. Like, I just do what, like, my instinct. I work on instinct. Everything I do is on my gut feeling, on my instinct. And I don't know, my instinct told me to do this line of work and told me that there's something to say and something to talk about. I only talk about and on things that I can talk about or on. I never try and go into worlds or speak on worlds that I don't know anything about. I think being a documentarian, my position is to sort of highlight worlds rather than like speak about them. But my whole point in getting into documentaries was because I was like, how many times are we going to watch pretty white people go to these spaces and be like pointing the finger or telling people they're wrong or like not willing to understand the other point of view? I think we have to move on from that. We have to have some sort of social understanding of how people are and how people live. And yes, I don't agree with the, you know, we don't agree with the radical people or we don't agree with terrorists, but there's a mindset and there's a reason they got there. And whether it's wrong or right, I just want to understand. And I think there's plenty of people that also probably are just like, what happened? How did you get to that stage? So I think that's a lot of my work is to do with that. Like, I just like, because I've always been a bit of an outsider, I like mixing with outsiders. I like figuring out what makes people tick and why they tick. So I'm always up for, I guess, just listening and talking about it and figuring it out and being open to being like, I'm wrong or like, I don't know this or like, teach me. I think we, as a society, maybe are better now, but I think the last 10 years we lacked a teach me, I don't know. And I think now we're getting a little bit better. We're a bit more like, okay, I didn't know this. And I think obviously BLM did that. And I think diversity became like cool and that did that. But I think we're a bit more open to each other now than we were. But I still think we've got a while to go.
So do you now see yourself as a kind of almost a cultural bridge between underrepresented voices and popular culture?
I guess so. I don't know if I'm a bridge. But I definitely think that I'm, well, yeah, I guess a bridge, a vessel. Like I always say, I'd like to be a vessel for people who like want to say something, but they can't figure out how to say it. And for me to be like, hey, say it. Like, here's a chance to say it.
Vessel's a better word than bridge, yeah.
No, bridge is good and people walk over bridges. Yeah, I guess so. I guess I would be a bridge. Again, like I wish I thought about it more. I don't know if I'm even that deep a thinker. I think I just do what feels right. And I think people think I formulated this plan or how did you get here? Or what did you do? And this is crazy. And like, how did you make a documentary? And how did you like make like this thing for Apple and for Facebook? And I'm like, I don't know. I just did. But honestly, it just started happening when I just started like talking about what I cared about and stopped being scared of being this person I was. I think I spent a lot of my, I'd say up to 25 years old, I was like, I don't want to say who I am. I don't want to talk about this. But I think I slowly, as like things, as I grew up and I, you know, I think 27, 28, 29, I was like, I need to figure out who I am. And I think all that's happened is all my work and all the things I do is just me trying to figure out who I am. And I'm just doing all these things and tapping into these different worlds and finding all these different career paths and being like, what works and what am I good at? And once I started trying, I realized that I was good at more things than I thought I was.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I was good at things. But once you do them, then you're like, oh, okay. I'm not bad at this one. I'm gonna do this again. So, yeah.
I listened to an interview that you did where you asked the question about what is creativity.
Yeah.
And I can't remember it verbatim, but it was something along the lines of, we're all creative.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Being creative is just telling the story that you have inside you. It doesn't matter what that is or what form that comes out as.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have the ability to do that.
I was never book smart. I failed most of my exams. If I didn't fail, it's great to pass. My parents were like, get our tutor for this, get our tutor for that. And I had like all these tutors and I still failed. Like, I just never, I was never smart at sort of retaining things that were like important. So I turned to creativity, and ironically, a lot of my grandfather was a tailor, and a lot of my family are quite creative and painters and drawers and whatever else. And so we have a real creative streak in our family. And I think creativity, when you're when you're part of the diaspora, or you have like strong African parents, is like a wild concept. They're just like, okay, fun what you're doing, but like, when are you doing what you're meant to do? So it was a struggle to even figure out. My parents, I have to say, were quite supportive in being like, okay, well, this is cool. Like, my dad would always be like, I tell him I'd done something, he'd be like, did they pay you? Like, that is all he cared about. Like, he was like, have they paid you? But I'm at a stage now where, like, thankfully, I can pay rent. But I think when I couldn't pay rent for, like, most of my adolescence, I think, yeah, I don't know, I just did what I had to do because I couldn't do what I was told to do. I think that was a huge part of it. I had to be creative or figure out a way of, I guess, making money and surviving, because I couldn't, you know, be a lawyer or a doctor or all those other things. I actually wish I could, but I'm not smart. I am smart.
You are smart, yeah.
I'm not that smart. I'm not like, go get a further education. I scraped everything. I scraped by.
Yeah.
But I got there.
Join the club.
Yeah. Creatives.
Indeed. Exactly. The documentary that you did for BBC Three. I don't want to get the title wrong. I have written it down. They're Inside the Real Saudi Arabia. Can you just give everyone who hasn't seen it, and if you haven't, you should definitely go and watch it.
Yeah.
A really quick synopsis, and then I'd just love to chat to you about the experience.
So the documentary is called Inside the Real Saudi Arabia, Why I Had to Leave. I hate that little bit at the end. I didn't really have to leave, but anyway. I didn't live there to have to leave. But anyway.
Okay.
just to correct you. It's basically the story of, I was born in Saudi Arabia, so it's the story of what my life could have been like if I hadn't have left. So I was born there, I lived there, so I was about 2 or 3, and then we moved to the Northern Ireland. So I go back and I stay with my aunts who still live there, and see what my life could have been like if I went out, if I made friends, if I went to events, if I wanted to drive. So I did all those things, and for anyone that hasn't seen it, I am not going to ruin the ending, but it took a bit of a dramatic turn, and things happened. And I was meant to be there for 2 weeks, so I was there for 6 days, but we still got a documentary out of it, so that's good.
full-length documentary.
Yeah, full-length documentary, 6 days, incredible. So what an adventure. That documentary, in hindsight, I look back on it and I was gutsy. Like, I watched it 6 months ago, and I was like, whoa, what am I doing? Like, I'm just walking around, like, I want to do this, I want to do that, I don't care. Like, I was really punchy. And I think that's, like, my parents always like, that's just you by nature. Like, you just kind of do what you want, like, and then worry about the consequences afterwards. My brother always used to say, ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
I truly believe in that as well.
So bad. It's not great advice when you can get in trouble. The documentary, at the time I did it and made it because I was still in my identity crisis. It's still like, who am I? What, maybe if I go back to Saudi Arabia, like, my parents had always wanted me to go and do the, you know, the journey to Mecca, and I sort of had pushed back on that a lot. I never wanted to go to Mecca because I had connected religion with this thing that was stopping me doing the things that my friends were doing. So when the opportunity came up with this documentary and we came up with the concept, and it was like, you know, you can go to Mecca and all these things, I was like, maybe this is like ripping a band-aid. Maybe this will help me figure out who I am. And truly, even though it does play out on screen, you can see it all over my face. I am a bit like, okay, now I need to figure this out. No, I kind of like it here, but do I like it here? But this is not a great place, but it's weird. There's nice people here. And I sort of am trying to figure that out as people are sort of watching it and sort of playing out. But I definitely think that it was a bridge. When that docu came out, I think I don't know how no one told me. I don't think anyone had to tell me, but I hadn't thought about people actually watching it. I just thought I'd make it.
And that was it. And then you forget about it. You move on.
So it came out, and then I just started getting stopped in the streets. And then I started getting DMs. Then I started getting emails. And I was just like, wait, what's going on? And then when my exec phoned me, and he was like, you know, it's only been out a week, but we've got nearly 3 million, and then it's got to like 7 million, and then it got to like 10 million.
Are these views?
Yeah, people, views. Okay, yeah. Yeah, and I was like, wait, what? So then I started getting stopped in the street, which is mind blowing.
That must be so bizarre.
People were like, hey, Massman. I was like, hello? Like, so, and people, even now, people will be like, I've seen you somewhere. And I'm like, yeah, no, but you haven't. But you have. You've seen it on your TV when you were like drinking your tea. But a lot of girls came to me, and a lot of girls were like, seeing you gave me hope, because I never seen someone go through what I'm going through. And when I, those kind of messages that I were getting were so important, because that's all I wanted. I want young girls like me, young, you know, Arab or African or Muslim or just any kind of girl to look at that and be like, hey, I'm like her.
Mm.
Because I'd watched so much TV and I was like, who am I like? Who's there for me to watch? And that person doesn't exist. So for young girls to come to me and be like, oh, I see me, you're me. And even young guys were like, you're like my sister, you're like my mom, you're like whatever. That's why I knew what I was doing was important. Because if one or two or 10 young girls can be like, I see me, that's all I wanted.
Yeah.
So yeah, it definitely made me realize I was doing the right thing. Even if it was scary and quite full on.
And has it given you now more of a focus on, maybe not actually the stories you want to tell, but the audience you want to impact?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, TV's still not easy. TV's still very much a white male world. I'm lucky that I just spent 6 months with Mindhouse, which is Louis Theroux's company, and I spent time with Louis and got to ask him questions and figure that out. I definitely want to tell the stories, but the problem about telling those stories is there appetite for those stories? And commissioners or publishing houses, whatever it is, you know, online houses, whatever, they need to see proof of concept, and you've got, and I do have proof of concept, but it's kind of like, okay, well, maybe that was just a one-off, but we can get this person to do this, or we can get this person to do that. And I'm like, okay, well, if I don't have a huge following, or I don't have, you know, I'm not at the height, I'm not Gordon Ramsay, I'm not at the height of my career, they almost are like, work your way up and find your way of getting there, and then we'll give you something, which is what's hard about TV. Like, you're like, I've shown you that I can do this.
Yeah, so they just looking for numbers now. Numbers. They just want to know, yeah, that's we're going to get the viewers.
That's why a lot of it is celebrities telling stories, because it's a view, and also fair enough, because numbers are money. It's a money game. Like, in the end, everyone's got, you know, it's an industry. So I definitely have thought about different ways and how to tell those stories that don't involve relying on someone else giving me permission to. So I think that's my next stage of figuring out. I obviously know these stories are important to tell.
Mm.
So how do I tell them? Like, expecting someone else to sort of give me an opportunity to tell them.
Yeah, of course.
That I'm just sort of still trying to figure out.
And would you ever consider someone else telling the stories for you?
Yes and no, because I think the beauty in me telling a lot of the stories is that, like, I'm just your everyday girl. Like, I'm not a big name, I'm not a big person, I'm not known worldwide, I'm just an everyday person. And I think sometimes you do need everyday people. Yeah, there's just a bit of talent. It's not like, presenting's not easy, like, hosting's not easy. But I would never want a story of a young black girl to be told by Gordon Ramsay, for instance. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of
course.
It
doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, in that sense, if there was another me, sure. Does that exist? I don't think so. Not that I've seen that isn't, like, investigated. The thing is, the things I made aren't investigative journalism, and a lot of TV, a lot of documentaries, and a lot of black men and women that make documentaries are usually investigative. I'm not naturally that kind of person.
Yeah.
I'm not the kind of person who's going to be like, why'd you do that? What's the reason? What, like, you know, like, I need to find out the reason that this happened. I'm not that kind of person. I'm more like, let me walk the path of this person and learn from them. So it's a lot more anthropology, it's a lot more philosophical, rather than it is like a yes and no answer.
Is there anything that you're focused on at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I am doing lots of various things at the moment. As I said, I was just with Louis Theroux and his company, and now I'm in-house with the BBC, with BBC Studios. I'm working on a narrative podcast. It'll be hopefully be 6 episodes long. There's a sparkling documentary concept in the background. I'm also working on a Instagram platform called Our Isolated World, which is also really super beautiful, because it's just people who send in voice notes of their stories of isolation in whatever way, in whatever why, not during this lockdown period, but just in life. So that's been really beautiful. And then what happened, to be perfectly honest, Lenny, is that I took on too many careers. So when I was, you know, in my mid-20s, I was like, I'm not making any money. I can't pay rent. What am I going to do? Okay, let's diversify. So I went from being a fashion stylist, to like, okay, I'm going to write. Let's write. Okay, let's write. Okay, then I'm going to make a documentary. Okay, I'll go out and make a documentary. Maybe I should direct this. Okay, should I? My first directing gig was like Facebook and Apple, which is wild. Like, those are huge companies. I remember them being like, oh, we'd like you to direct this thing. And I was like, what? Like,
what? Have you seen have any you of seen my anything? Direct? Yeah.
I haven't seen anything. So then I ended up being a director. So now, like, when people say to you, you know, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I'm a fashion stylist, I'm a director, I'm a writer, I'm a TV presenter. I, you know, also host events as well. Like, I host loads of events for, like, Apple and Soho House. And, like, so I think what I need to do now is maybe actually work a little bit backwards and focus on, now bring it in a bit and yeah. narrow in. Because what I've done is I've done this vast kind of, like, what are you working on right now? And if I could tell you, I'd be surprised. I don't know what happens. I don't know what's happening tomorrow. I'm really not sure what happened yesterday. It's a bit mental. And I think when you're creative, you're like, I can do it all. But actually, I need to be good at doing one thing.
Yeah. Although I've heard the term multi-potentialite mm-hmm. thrown around.
Listen, it's not that fun. It's not fun.
Previously. And I'd say you're a bit of a multi-potentialite.
I am. And it's great and it's amazing. And it means I have all these avenues of, you know, financial avenues and whatever else, but I also, it's like burnout central around here, because we have all been locked into our houses in this one city for so long. Before it'd be like, okay, I work really, really hard, let me go take a week break somewhere, like in Europe. Okay, I work really hard, okay, I'm gonna take a week somewhere and just like zen out for a minute. I think now it's like a phone addiction, constant reply, like just before, like even walking here, like I just said to you, I was like, okay, I got 20 minutes on the Peloton just because before I got here, because I had to do all this stuff this morning, but I really wanted to go to the gym. And it's like that rat race is not healthy for anyone.
Yeah.
So I think there's an element of sort of being like, okay, I've got so many brilliant things, but I'm not entirely sure what I should do next. And that's, I think, the stage I need to work out.
So to finish off, one final question. Mm-hmm. Can you offer us something that we should read, listen to, or watch that has helped you gain an insight into a culture that's unfamiliar to your own?
Solid. Do you know what? I just actually, two things. I finished reading a book called Black Sugar, which is really good. It's based in India, and it's this girl and her relationship with her mother. And you can't tell if she is in the relationship with her mother or if she's making up this relationship with her mother. And it just like takes, so she talks very naturally about like in India and the food they eat and what's happening and her in-laws and stuff. That was lovely. And then one documentary that inspired my whole documentary making was Goddesses of Nepal. And it's about child goddesses. And I just find it so fascinating that they've got these little girls who are not allowed to touch the floor, not allowed to do anything, not allowed to read or write. And they just survive so people can pray to them, and they're like 6 years old. So I just find that, I just was like, wow, what a fascinating world. So yeah, definitely those two things, two very different cultures, because I think that's what I want people to do, delve into different cultures, look at different worlds, like what we're in our little bubble here and our little echo chamber that we're in.
Yeah,
get out of it. You'll learn so much if you just like aren't closed off to the opportunity of learning.
What a wonderful note to finish up on. Before I leave you, I just want to offer up a few thank yous. Firstly, to Basma for sharing her time with us and being so open and honest. Secondly, to Soho House for allowing us to use their studio. And last, but by no means least, to the ferociously talented Moss Gatherer who provided the tunes. I'll leave a link in the description to his debut EP, entitled One, which is out now on XVI Records. I've also left some links to the recommendations that Basma shared with us. Until next time.